It is fascinating to note that English speakers have over 1 million words at our disposal. And every year, about 1,000 new words are made it into our dictionaries. This includes words like blog and woke, crowdfunding, anti-fragile, airball, e-marketing, Sudoku, Brexit, and my favorite, nearlywed. But these are just the tip of the iceberg. According to something called the Global Language Monitor, about 5,000 new words are created every year in English. Only about 1,000 or so are deemed worthy of a dictionary entry, which makes me wonder, where do new words come from? And what I found that is that there's in fact a lot of different ways. There's a process called repurposing. For example, a computer mouse was named after a long-tailed animal because of the cord that came out from the device that connected to the computer. Same thing for words like tablet. Used to be a tablet was only that, and a cloud. There are abbreviations. The word taxi came from the word taximeter. The word cab came from the word cabriolet, which is a single, it's a carriage with a cover on it that is pulled by a horse for hire. Goodbye, God be with you. Rifle, a rifled pistol. Scuba, self-contained underwater breathing apparatus. And on top of all of this is a category of words that we call loan words, words which are borrowed from other languages. In fact, in English, there are words from almost 350 different languages, words that have flowed into our common use, such as cookie and noodle, ranch, karaoke, and just think of all the Yiddish and Hebrew words, too, that we use commonly in English. Schlep, zhlub, tsuris, mazel tov, shalom. But for this morning, there is a loan word from German in particular that comes to my mind. The word is empathy. And it didn't exist until 120 years ago. Honestly, the word did not exist. As the study of psychology and sociology blossomed, the word was drawn from another made-up word, a made-up German word called Einfühlung, which means to be with another person. And that became the source for the word empathy. Before this, we didn't have a word for it. Not just for recognizing another person's suffering, but also for feeling it. Which is to say that you might see someone stressing over a lost job, or a broken heart, or the pain of illness. You might see their suffering, but that's not enough. Because empathy asks that you feel what they feel. Empathy asks that you imagine standing in their place and absorb the pain or fear that another person is carrying with themselves. In other words, despite the fact that human beings, Homo sapiens, have existed for over 300,000 years, it took only 120 years to find the word which makes us deeply human in the best of ways. But you might be mistaken to believe that until 120 years ago, without the word, humans may have lacked the empathy. All what we actually lacked was the word, not the lessons. Of which this lesson, the foundational holy day of Passover, frames for us exquisitely. Our story begins as the Israelites were slaves for hundreds of years in Egypt, baking bricks and building pyramids and palaces for generations upon generations. But in human working conditions alone didn't seem to be a divine casus belli, a reason for God to turn and move into action to make it stop. So the Torah proceeds to tell us that the Pharaoh had a series of nightmares that are described in Jewish tradition, predicting that his rule would come to a calamitous end. That a man, a leader, would be born soon to the Hebrews, who would bring ruin to Egypt and take his people away. As Stalin would say thousands of years later, if you get rid of the man, you get rid of the problem. So Pharaoh orders every Hebrew baby to be thrown into the Nile River. To be extra sure, Jewish tradition says, he ordered not just the baby boys, but also the baby girls. Pharaoh commands the entire people of Egypt. He enlists the participation of the entire nation in the infanticide of the Israelite children, and he tells them, Vayitzav Paro l'chol amo, and he tells, commands to all the Egyptians, take the children and throw them into the Nile. And it was then that the ancient rabbis teach that when it was children who had been made the victim, it was only then that God had seen enough. That seemingly slavery alone, that inhumane working conditions weren't sufficient. But it was when our children brought the events to what they became to be. And I think it is for this reason that the most endearing and enduring moments of the Seder are the very ones which feature our children. The four questions where they ask us for wisdom. The opening of the door of Elijah, where they come and bring in a hope and express a desire for a better future. The finding of the Afikoman, because no Seder can conclude without us eating it, just like there can be no tomorrow without our children. And whilst there are Seder tables, certainly that will differ from each other, there are those with many children and those with few, or perhaps none. But the architecture of the Seder is about our children. And yet only this is half of the argument. To understand this better, we have to go deeper. And the story from this point moves very, very quickly. Moses is spared and placed into a basket, plucked out of the Nile and raised in Pharaoh's palace. As a grown man, he turns against the tyrant, his father, the Pharaoh, and intercedes on behalf of the Israelites. And then to save his own life, runs away. And when he finally comes back to Egypt, he comes with the message of the God of the people of Israel. Let them go or else. And the or else is a cascade of plagues. The first of them is the transformation of all the Egyptian water into blood. And in trying to understand the meaning of the plague, we're better asked, why is it first? And that is because it was a sign and a signal to the Egyptians to remember what they had done to the Israelite children, how they ripped newly born children from their mothers and drowned them in that same water that now turned to blood. They might have thought that as the tide carried those lifeless bodies downstream, that the memory of the crime was carried away too. But for the first plague, the water in their home turns to blood to say to them, it is not forgotten. And at that moment, the Egyptians should have said, go. Because what was done and what had happened to you was horrible, and our holding of you is defenseless. The blood and water was meant to be a sign to their sin and a warning to not compound it. It was time to let the parents of those deceased children free. And as you know, they didn't do that. And with that, 8 more plagues ensue, each one more terrifying and punitive to the last. And with each one, Pharaoh vacillates. But since you know the story, you also know that there is one plague left. In the 10th and final plague, which is the plague of the firstborn, the Israelites are commanded to make their way into their homes and lock their doors. And out of that evening, death comes to the firstborn of every Egyptian, including Pharaoh himself. And with that, Pharaoh calls and gives the command to set the Israelites free. The tragedy of this lesson is clear, that it was only when the horror touched them, only when what the Israelites had suffered at their hands came to visit upon them, could they then understand what they had done? Because one of the things that makes us human, deeply, truly human, is the gift of moral imagination. Moral imagination enables us to consider what our actions can mean to another person, to imagine ourselves in their place and time. Moral imagination enables us to understand the pain of losing a job, even when your employment is secure, to feel the pain of a lost love, no matter should your home be complete, to touch the searing hurt of the loss of a child, even if you haven't been spared such a tragedy. These things don't have to happen to us for you to know how painful they must be. The moral imagination in the story is the story of empathy. Empathy is to travel to a deep part inside of yourself and find the emotions and pain that the other person is feeling. And you can do this because each of these kinds of losses are things that we fear. And because we fear them, we can also feel them. The failure to do this is the failure of our humanity. And Pesach is the story of humans finding the roots of our humanity, which is the creation of the Jewish people. And yet, for all that said, on this day of Yizkor, there's something else that must be acknowledged. At the conclusion of the ninth plague, Pharaoh calls for Moses and Aaron. Over these nine plagues, Pharaoh has teeter-tottered back and forth. He'll say that the Israelites can go, and then he changes his mind. He'll offer them to let the elders go, but to leave the younger ones behind, or only the men, and the families, however, must stay in Egypt. But after this ninth plague, he bursts out into anger in Moses. Lech me'alai shamalacha, he says to him. Be gone from me, Pharaoh says to Moses. You will never see me again. And Moses replies, Kein dibarta, you have spoken rightly. I shall not see your face again. Which is confounding because Moses does see Pharaoh again. After that 10th and final plague, Moses is called to the same Pharaoh and is told by him finally to leave. Take everything and everyone and go and don't come back. And the deeper truth is the person Moses saw that last time was not the same man he was before because he had just lost his son. His face was not the same. And he would never be the same man again. This is to say that to lose those you love is to forever be different. It is to be changed from the loss. It is to see where they are no more. But it is also to know that because you are changed, that they are forever with you. Chag Sameach.